Today is Sunday, March 24th, and I'm going to begin this morning by reading an article by David Brooks. He's a columnist for the New York Times, and the title of his article is When the Good Do Bad. This is him commenting on this recent massacre of Afghan civilians by somebody in the military, a man named Robert Bales. Pretty horrific and pretty dismaying for anyone to read about. But he has some interesting things to say about the way we frame it and the way we look at it. So I'll just plunge in here. Just before I do, just for people who don't know, this fellow Robert Bales was assigned to a pretty dangerous area in turmoil in Afghanistan. And apparently at some point something went very wrong with him, and he made two trips off the base and killed a number of families, civilians, and children. These weren't enemy combatants by any means. And now he's under arrest, and of course there's it's just a horrific situation. Anyway, David Brooks begins. He says it's always interesting to read the quotations of people who knew a mass murderer before he killed. They usually express complete bafflement that a person who seemed so kind and normal could do something so horrific. Friends of Robert Bales, who is accused of massacring 16 Afghan civilians, I believe the number is up to 17 now, have expressed similar thoughts. Friends and teachers describe him as caring, gregarious, and self-confident before he, in the vague metaphor of common usage, apparently snapped. As one childhood friend told the Times, "That's not our Bobby. Something horrible, horrible had to happen to him." Any of us would be shocked if someone we knew and admired killed children. But these days it's especially hard to think through these situations because of the worldview that prevails our culture. According to this view, most people are naturally good because nature is good. The monstrosities of the world are caused by the few people like Hitler or Idi Amin who are fundamentally warped and evil. This worldview gives us an easy conscience because we don't have to contemplate the evil in ourselves. It used to be, you'd hear the phrase there, "But for the grace of God, go I." I don't hear anybody say that anymore, but it's true. Under the right circumstances, the right environment, right factors, any one of us could do horrific things. And when we hear a story like this, our immediate reaction is to stick that guy in the other category. That's something beyond me or my friends or my family or my institution or my country. Well, not my country, unfortunately. That's what makes it difficult for Americans. He says, when somebody who seems mostly good does something completely awful, we're rendered mute or confused. But of course it happens all the time. That's because even people who contain reservoirs of compassion and neighborliness also possess a latent potential to commit murder. You know, it reminds me, I don't know how many people remember, it's a number of years back, the whole siege of Sarajevo, you know, after the wall fell down and the communist grip on Eastern Europe relaxed. Yugoslavia, which had been held together under a communist dictator, was all of a sudden free to go its way, and it split into various ethnic and religious groups, Serbians and Bosnians, probably the two main groups, Muslim and Christian. And Sarajevo, which had been a city, a really cosmopolitan city with intermarriages between people of different religions, different ethnic backgrounds, all of a sudden, no one could trust anyone else. You know, all the whole control had been taken off, and all of a sudden, people who'd been neighbors of yours for generations, of your families for generations, couldn't be trusted. And I don't think it's been put back together in the sense of regaining trust by any means. The siege of Sarajevo went on for something like 4 years. It was actually longer than the siege of Stalingrad, and thousands and thousands of innocent civilians were killed during this period. And it was all the more poignant because Sarajevo had been the site of the Winter Olympics not that long before. Went from being this, you know, sort of enchanted destination to a little piece of hell. Same people, just different circumstances. He goes on, David Buss of the University of Texas asked his students if they had ever thought seriously about killing someone, and if so, to write out their homicidal fantasies in an essay. He was astonished to find that 91% of the men and 84% of the women, coming along pretty nicely, had detailed, vivid homicidal fantasies. He was even more astonished to learn how many steps some of his students had taken toward carrying them out. One woman invited an abusive ex-boyfriend to dinner with thoughts of stabbing him in the chest. A young man in a fit of road rage pulled a baseball bat out of his trunk and would have pummeled his opponent if he hadn't run away. Another young man planned the progression of his murder, crushing a former friend's fingers, puncturing his lungs, then killing him. These thoughts do not arise from playing violent video games, Buss argues. They occur because we are descended from creatures who killed to thrive and survive. We're natural-born killers, and the real question is not what makes people kill, but what prevents them from doing so. People who murder often live in situations that weaken sympathy and restraint. People who commit massacres, for example, often live with what the researchers call forward panic. After having endured a long period of fear, they find their enemies in a moment of vulnerability. Their fear turns to rage, and as Steven Pinker writes in The Better Angels of Our Nature, they explode into a savage frenzy. It's definitely a great risk at periods of fear when the adrenaline is really surging. It's so common, for instance, for police when they're chasing down a suspect. When they finally get him, there's just this release of anger. It's really, really like anyone else. They're afraid. And when they get their perpetrator, it takes a great deal of professionalism and restraint not to wail on him, not to beat the crap out of him. And, of course, that professionalism and restraint is not always there, and you get that. You get that all the time. We're not really genetically all that different from chimpanzees. I remember seeing a special about chimpanzee culture. They're eerily similar to humans. They have their territories, and periodically one band of chimpanzees will invade the territory of another. It's usually the young male chimpanzees, of course, and they just go wild. It's just it's an orgy of violence. It's something that's in us. The right triggers, and it can come out. He says, in centuries past, most people would have been less shocked by the homicidal eruptions of formerly good men. That's because people in those centuries grew up with a worldview that put sinfulness at the center of the human personality. Here we're getting into Christian theology. A little shaky ground for me. He says, John Calvin, of course the founder of Calvinism, believed that babies come out depraved. And he was sort of right. The most violent stage of age of life is age 2. My granddaughter is now 3, and she is a little less violent now. usually at age two, there's this other baby that's come into the picture. And it's alarming to watch this beautiful child dropping toys on her brother. He said G.K. Chesterton, another Christian writer, wrote that the doctrine of original sin is the only part of Christian theology that can be proved. Not sure exactly how that gets proved. Roshi is fond of saying that in Buddhism we turn that upside down. Instead of the doctrine of original sin, we have the doctrine of original perfection. But this isn't the same as this sort of sweet idea that everybody's basically good. Because, as the Buddha said upon his enlightenment, wonder of wonders, all beings are whole and complete, lacking nothing. But because their minds are turned upside down by delusive thinking, they fail to perceive this. And this is really what we're working against, is our habits, our ingrained, lifelong, lifetimes long, centuries and centuries of delusive thinking in ourselves, in our culture, of self and other, of seeing the problem outside ourselves, even seeing ourselves as outside ourselves. Said this old worldview held that people are a problem to themselves. The inner world is a battlefield between light and dark, and life is a struggle against the destructive forces inside. The worst thing you can do is, in a fit of pride, to imagine your insecurity comes from outside and try to resolve it yourself. If you try to fix the other people who you think are responsible for your inner turmoil, you'll end up trying to kill them, or maybe whole races of them. It's not just the story of the 20th century or this century. This is the story of human history. It's hard to believe, but we're actually probably living in the least violent period of human history. So this earlier worldview was both darker and brighter than the one prevailing today. It held, as C.S. Lewis put it, that there is no such thing as an ordinary person. Each person you sit next to on the bus is capable of extraordinary horrors and extraordinary heroism. According to this older worldview, Robert Bales, like all of us, is a mixture of virtue and depravity. His job, and of course we can say our job, is to struggle daily to strengthen the good and resist the evil, policing small transgressions to prevent the larger ones. Policing small transgressions to prevent the larger ones. It's really a good point. So much of our nature is the result of little thoughts that we indulge. How much do we indulge those homicidal fantasies if we have them? And according to this one guy's research, most people do. My own poll of myself and my wife is 2 for 2. He says if he didn't do that, if he didn't prevent the larger ones, if he was swept up in a whirlwind, then even a formerly good man is capable of monstrous acts that shock the soul and sear the brain. It seems a little simplistic. You know, it's basically do good and avoid evil. A lot of people know the story of the Zen master who did Zazen up in a tree, apparently pretty famous back in ancient China. The governor of a province came to him for advice, looked up at him and said, you're in a pretty precarious position up there in that tree. And the master said to the governor, no, you're in a pretty precarious position down there, which took the governor back a little bit. And so he followed up with a question and asked, well, what advice do you have for me? And the master said, do good and avoid evil. And the governor said, well, that's That's pretty simple. I mean, a four-year-old child knows that. Yes, a four-year-old child knows it, but an 80-year-old man can't do it. So much of our problem is that our thinking is so stupid and so simplistic. Just this story here with Robert Bales, you hear this story and you have a picture of Robert Bales in your mind. And inevitably that picture has to be simplistic because we don't know him. It has to be tinged with judgment. And we do this same thing with everyone. We do it with politicians, people in the news. People are demonizing Obama. People are demonizing Gingrich and Romney and Santorum. Sometimes it seems like for good reason. But we don't know them. Any picture we have of them is just a piece of shorthand. It's really not the person. It's just a construct in our minds. We do it with political parties and with movements. You know, some people are contemptuous of the Tea Party. Some people are contemptuous of Occupy Wall Street. How could a political movement possibly be all good or all bad? How could it possibly be summed up in a picture? And yet, because of the way our minds work, we all have a picture. Somebody says Tea Party, and something pops into our head. I always see somebody wearing a tri-corner hat for some reason. And then that same tendency to just have shorthand pictures of people and movements extends to the people that we know. It also extends to people that we know, that we experience over time. Nevertheless, when someone mentions them, when we sum them up, or when we run into them, immediately a judgment pops into place. This is a person who talks too much. This is a person who's selfish. This is a person who's full of himself or full of herself. This is a person who's dangerous. This is a person who may be critical of me. This is a person I love. This is a great guy. This is my wonderful friend. We default to our picture and we don't see the person because we're living in our head and we're not living in the world, living in our body. We're always either grasping at things or we're warding them off, people and things. And this habit of pushing them away, pulling them closer, trying to engage them, trying to hold them at arm's length, basically looking for what we like and trying to avoid what we don't like, this habit of manipulation makes us feel rushed and pressured, as if we don't have time to take them in. It's so helpful to just relax for a moment and see who's in front of you. Let them show you who they are. It's not that it's so hard to do, it's just that it's so hard to remember to do. I want to read a little passage here from my good friend, Anthony DeMello. People are probably tired of hearing from him. I have the trouble giving a Dharma talk without dipping into him. But he keeps saying what I want to say. Anthony DeMello, for those who don't know, was a Jesuit priest born in India. He's dead now, but he taught all over the world. Pretty remarkable guy. And let me just read what he says. He says, how can you love people when you need people? You can only use them. If I need you to make me happy, I've got to use you. I've got to manipulate you. I've got to find ways and means of winning you. I cannot let you be free. I can only love people when I have emptied. I can only love people when I have emptied my life of people. When I die to the need for people, then I'm right in the desert. Of course, for a Christian, the desert is the place to be. In the beginning, it feels awful. It feels lonely. But if you can take it for a while, you'll suddenly discover that it isn't lonely at all. It is solitude. It is aloneness. And the desert begins to flower. Dogen said, to study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be confirmed by the 10,000 things. The desert begins to flower. Since then at last you'll know what love is, what God is, what reality is. But in the beginning, giving up the drug can be tough unless you have a very keen understanding or unless you have suffered enough. I like the fact that he calls it a drug. Really, our manipulation of people, our warding them off, our identifying with them or not identifying with them, is a drug that almost everyone is addicted to. And it has the same short-term benefits and long-term disaster of any drug. We manipulate people, we can get what we want in the short term, maybe. We can avoid their anger by doing our little dance. But we've cut ourselves off from our lives. It says, unless you've suffered enough. It's a great thing to have suffered. Only then can you get sick of it. You can make use of suffering to end suffering. Most people simply go on suffering. That explains the conflict I sometimes have between the role of spiritual director and that of therapist. A therapist says, let's ease the suffering. The spiritual director says, let her suffer. She'll finally get sick of this way of relating to people, and she'll decide to break out of this prison of emotional dependence on others. Shall I offer a palliative or remove a cancer? It's not easy to decide. It's a dilemma for the Zen teacher, too. But usually the Zen teacher seems to default on the side of letting us suffer. It says, a person slams a book on the table in disgust. Let him keep slamming it on the table. Don't pick up the book for him and tell him it's all right. Spirituality is awareness. Awareness. When your mother got angry with you, she didn't say there was something wrong with her. She said there was something wrong with you. Otherwise, she wouldn't have been angry. Well, I made a great discovery that if you are angry, mother, there's something wrong with you. So you'd better cope with your anger. Stay with it and cope with it. It's not mine. Whether there's something wrong with me or not, I'll examine that independently of your anger. I'm not going to be influenced by your anger. Such a big point. When someone flares up at us, immediately what we want to do is defend ourselves. But really, I mean, it's helpful to have people get angry at us because it does often point out something in us that we might take time to look at. But if our immediate reaction is to somehow placate them, get them not to be angry at us, or justify ourselves, then the anger does us no good. Then we're just buying into that same sort of people-pleasing, people-avoiding habit that separates us from our lives. It says, the funny thing is that when I can do this without feeling any negativity towards another, I can be quite objective about myself too. Only a very aware person can refuse to pick up the guilt and anger and say, you're having a tantrum, too bad, I don't feel the slightest desire to rescue you anymore, and I refuse to feel guilty. He goes on, I'm not going to hate myself for anything I've done. That's what guilt is. I'm not going to give myself a bad feeling and whip myself for anything I've done, either right or wrong. I'm ready to analyze it, to watch it, and say, well, if I did wrong, it was in unawareness. Nobody does wrong in awareness. It's a fine line. We need to take our mistakes to heart. We need to find some way to correct our behavior when we're hurting other people. But beating up on ourselves and shrinking from other people's anger isn't the way to do it. It's a wonderful thing when your teacher can blast you and you can just let it run right through you. Roshi's fond of saying anger is just energy. Have to watch out for his self-righteous anger. What we want to do in practice is to open up to what is, whatever it is. To the extent that we're shrinking from pain, we can't do that. And there are just all kinds of pain. It can be something as small as a little bit of tension in your chest. You're sitting and you feel a little uncomfortable feeling. What do you do with that? The most skillful thing is to just relax into it. Find out about it. Be curious about it. It doesn't help to say, I shouldn't be feeling this way. If I was a better Zen student, you know, my posture would be better, my mind would be clearer. I'd be happier. I'd be more confident. It's you've now taken the simplistic pictures you have of other people, and now you've got a simplistic picture of yourself based on what you like and what you don't like. We're just a process. Things are shifting and changing. And if we're on this path, why do we need to worry about where we are on the path? Why do we need to worry about whether we're a good student or a bad student, or we have people's approval or we don't have people's approval? The fact of the matter is, approval is a crappy drug. And you can't get enough of it. You simply cannot get enough of it. You have the feeling that if I could just make it somehow, just get final approval, I could relax for a moment. Then I could get into my practice. What I've found is approval just doesn't last. It's a saying that one aw shit wipes out 100 attaboys. Approval and disapproval, two of the eight worldly winds in Buddhism. And it's liberating to be free of both. I look forward to the day when I can give a talk and not really care whether people think it's a good talk or a bad talk. Day's probably a ways off, though. It's as practice begins to take hold, we begin to see this other way of taking the world in, the way of no preferences. You know, what we chant, verses on the faith mind, when preferences are cast aside, the way stands clear and undisguised. This is really simple and basic. It's really true. When you're not grasping and you're not warding off, the whole world opens up. And as you begin to experience that from time to time, little bits here and there, you begin to have some faith in it. It becomes your refuge. It's a totally different way of handling life, handling adversity. One good measure of your state of awareness is how much do people annoy you? It's a good thing to look at. How much of your initial reaction to people around you, the people you know, the people you see walking down the street, somebody you have no idea, you just see they walk down the street, they've got a certain posture, a certain way of walking. Are you annoyed? If you're truthful with yourself, the answer often is yes. But one of the fruits of practice is to have that start to shift. Maybe I'm just a bad case, and for me it's remarkable that I see people and I'm not annoyed at them, but I find lately I see someone and I like them. You know, it's probably just as stupid as my dislike, but there it is. People behind a counter, or the waitress at a restaurant. It's every time someone new comes in front of our screen, so to speak, we have an opportunity to just look, just see. There's something remarkable there that we cannot possibly sum up. Our judgments are inadequate. St. Thomas Aquinas said, what did he say? All the efforts of the human mind cannot exhaust the essence of a single fly. How much more so a single person? When I first got to the center, there was an article about Roshi Kaplow in the New York Times Magazine. And the one thing that stuck with me from that article was Roshi saying, there's beauty in an angry face. It's really hard to grasp for me. There's beauty in an angry face. But it's true. If we're not afraid of that angry face, then it's really interesting. It's fascinating. It's a wrathful deity. They stick them outside Zen temples in China. It's this business about not being annoyed with people. This isn't like, okay, I'm annoyed, I have to stop being annoyed. This is something that I shouldn't be doing. Somehow I have to bury it, grit my teeth. It's the same as with anything. We see it. All we can do is bring awareness to it. See the reaction rising in myself, my impatience. Don't kid yourself. And don't judge yourself. If you do both those things, you're in good shape. When you have those negative reactions, it's really a wake-up call. It's like Anthony DeMello was saying, Mother, you've got a problem with yourself. Why am I angry? Somebody else in this situation wouldn't be angry. They wouldn't be annoyed. What is it in me that's bringing this reaction? If you can bring a little curiosity to it and not the, oh God, I need to get out of this horrible mind state, then there's room for things to move, for things to shift and change. Our practice is really one of making space, of getting outside of time, dropping our agenda. And we can't do that until we let go of all our labels and our expectations. Have to accept on a deep level that things aren't supposed to be in any particular way. Things are as they are. How could they be any other way? Practice isn't about learning facts or gaining approval. It's about intimacy. It's about finding our way in. I love the story of the Buddha just before his great enlightenment when he sat down underneath the Bo tree. He remembered a scene from his childhood sitting underneath another tree, a rose apple tree, near his father's palace in the fields. The world just opened up to him and he saw. Remembering that opening, he knew the way. And he sat down and came to his great awakening. We all have these moments when our petty concerns and judgments drop away and the world opens up. And that's where we need to head. It's not being a good Zen student. In fact, I find it a little painful to talk about it in terms of Zen. I don't know if anybody else has this experience, but I read Tricycle or Shambhala Sun, one of the Buddhist magazines, and I always feel a little sick afterwards. It's just, you know, so much of what we do. Even making a talk makes me a little nauseous. So much of what we do is, you know, follow my recipe and, you know, you'll measure up, or, you know, you'll get these results. It's really, all we want to do is just return to being ourselves. It's Zen is the best way I've ever found for me of opening up to my life. But there was a Zen teacher who said, if you say the word Buddha, wash your mouth out with soap. The minute it becomes this special thing, it's crap. You can misunderstand some of this and take the position that everything is as it is, I am as I am, feeling guilt does no good, I think I'll play video games, or I'll just do as I please. Everything is just as it is, and everything is changing, everything is in flux. We're not good, we're not bad, but we're called on to respond. We're called on to join in the dance, to enter into it. Everything is to as it is, and there's a tremendous amount of work to be done. These two are not contradictory. There's a saying in Zen, somewhere the Buddha is still working on himself. It's actually hard to think of anything better to do than to work on ourselves. When by working on ourselves, we just mean open up. Drop the barriers. See more. Become more aware. Become more real. How could that be onerous? It's not the job of a Boy Scout. It's the job of a human being. Well, I feel better, I think, if I stop talking now. And if anybody has any questions or comments, yeah, Duane.
I like what you say, but David Brooks is a shaky platform. There isn't anything in that article that discusses the society and the army that demanded his loyalty and sent him beyond his means into that situation.
Yeah, it's remarkable that it doesn't happen more often. That was, I think, his third or fourth deployment. But that article, but in defense of David Brooks, he really isn't addressing the whole situation. I think he's just talking about our problem, which is demonizing people who do horrific things and failing to see that in ourselves. I don't think he was setting out to address the rights or wrongs of American military policy. There's no question that you keep stressing people and someone's going to break. It might not have been predictable that it would have been him. You know, there was a lot of other things. I read a lot about his situation, and his wife had just had to sell their house for less than they owed on the mortgage, and he was passed over for promotions, and all sorts of things were going wrong, and he was drinking, which might have had a bit of an effect. I've heard it does. But yeah, I'm not holding up David Brooks as Shanti Deva or anything. Yeah.
John, I have trouble keeping my mouth shut about politicians, especially the current cast of fools who are, as I make a judgment about them, I feel like I need to speak up, at least to myself, that people are lying. I mean,
yeah, well, yeah. Yep.
This is just crazy. I mean, it's, and I want to be compassionate about Dick Cheney, but it's so hard. He just had a heart transplant, I read.
I'm really glad to hear he got a heart. That's Yeah, I know. And he certainly, you know, an informed citizenry is important, and part of the being informed is, you know, seeing what's there and making judgments about it, but then you can carry it too far. You know, there are so many people that are just in a swivet about it. It's pretty astounding, you know. I mean, it seems like it's political discourse is worse and less anchored to reality than it's ever been. But then again, you know, over 100 years ago, somebody was cane whipping somebody else in the floor of the Senate. You know, it's people. And I like there's a line in a Bob Dylan song, it's just something we're going to have to forget. You know, there's, I can't make Mitt Romney tell the truth. I can't make Obama live up to his campaign promises. You know, I can note what's been done. I can, you know, if I want to be politically active, I can, you know, spread the word and all that stuff. But there's, the anger is my problem, mm-hmm. You know. Yeah, there's plenty of stuff that's great kindling for anger. And, you know, we're just, it's like a feast. But, yeah, and sometimes your anger can be maybe productive, you know, but usually not. And the amazing thing is that you can go from saying, okay, you know, these people are idiots, therefore, anybody who supports them is an idiot. But that's not true. There are a lot of people who are, you know, rock-solid conservatives, and somehow or other they can find a way to vote for Sarah Palin or whatever. I can't understand it, but they're not defective. You know, they just are seeing things in a different light. You know, their limited viewpoint is limited in a different way from mine. I'm right and they're wrong, in my opinion. But they're not, you know, I remember we had a symposium once, and somebody raised their hand and basically questioned the moral integrity of anybody who could be a Republican. And I remember thinking, no, that's not right. You know, there are Republicans who are better people than I am. You know, it's got to be. Got to be. There's so many of them. There's got to be one. So, yeah, it's just, it's not, I don't have an easy answer to that. Yeah.
Last night was the Syracuse basketball game, which is one of the few sporting events I watch all year. And I was amazed, really amazed at how quickly I regressed in a way to, you know, us versus them, and really a biased preference for Syracuse, and biased sort of demonization. although I did observe that demonization was much better than what it used to be years ago, especially watching football. I think many of us who watched football used to sort of hope for injuring the other players. That was really sort of disturbing my mental state. Watching the game, anxiety, sort of negative feelings when the other team did well. And then I just had the insight that, you know, the sports is a big part of our culture, and that reinforces the us versus them dichotomy that we see in politics and in wars and perhaps other social relationships.
Yeah, they're games, and you know, a game can be fun, but it's when you get into the mind state of winning and losing, you know, then you're really trapped. And I think the one place where I see it more than any other is when you get into an argument, you know, like a domestic argument, or you know, husband arguing with wife or whatever. If both parties are trying to win, it can't go anywhere. It can't get fixed. But it's amazing if you forget about winning. It's like, yeah, you're right. You know, I should have picked up those socks, you know, instead of, you know, why are you making such a big deal about picking up my socks? You know, is that really causing you such a problem? Why do you have to constantly be picking on me? You know, if the socks bother you, why don't you pick them up? It's so much easier when we're willing to lose in that limited sense, when there's nothing to defend. In a sporting context, watching a game, I have that problem too. You know, the game was going on yesterday. I was quite interested in it. I also had this talk to do, so I mixed the two a little bit. But I approached it with, I know Syracuse is going to lose, and it's just going to be a bad experience for me. So I just tuned into the end and said, yep, they're losing, and turned it back off. There's really every team has jerks and wonderful people on it. It's just like political movements, like Republicans and Democrats, you know.
I impose my judgment, though, of somebody being a jerk just by their scoring.
Yeah, really. Not shame on you. Just a lot of grist for the mill. You know? It's nice to see it. Al, you had something.
Yes. I find it fascinating. And you were talking about labels, how we really won't get to that part of being ourselves unless we drop the walls and we drop the labels. The labels, they seem to have a power. I find it fascinating how in the stories they use this fantastic label that we're fascinated in our culture is children. And it seems that once you put children were hurt, it's like you can justify anything or demonize anybody. And we forget that our children, ourselves, are not that great. We forget about Columbine, and we forget about all the other crimes that children have committed. I have a granddaughter who have three grandkids, and two that are very good, and the middle one that, oh my God, I mean, where did these kids come from? you know,
sounds like from you.
I think it's on the father's side of me. I mean, that's not my blood. But again, you know, here is a moment. I mean, what do you do with this kid? I mean, you have all these labels. How do you proceed? Do you drop your walls or do you spank the kid? I mean, how do you proceed without injuring this kid's childhood? I've noticed that we get in our way. And when I've been there with them, I've noticed myself getting in the way with the old labels of how I grew up and how they respond better when I drop the labels. But then again, they have their own walls, you know.
Sure.
Sure,
yeah, and they may need to suffer and do things wrong and you know, hopefully find their way. It is remarkable when your own walls drop and you can just respond. I had, you know, a little experience many years ago. I came home from Sachin and my son was in his teenage years and I just didn't have that normal negative reaction to his bullshit that I normally had. And, you know, it was just a little moment and it was like, wow, that just feels totally okay. And I know it had a little effect on him, you know, would that I could have kept it up through his, you know, through his teenage years. But, you know, by the time they're 40, they usually turn around. Okay, well, I hear the bell ringing. It tolls for us. So... let's stop here and recite the four vows.